Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is a text number, and 0818 715 815. Professor Michael O'Grady is a consultant paediatrician and paediatric endocrinologist. He's the national clinical lead for paediatric diabetes, and he's based in the Midland Regional Hospital in Mullingar. Michael, this is a devastating letter. What prompted you to write it to the parents in this way?
Well, I suppose, Joe, it's really important that parents know why, you know, their emails aren't being responded to, why there's nobody at the end of the phone like there should be. So, I mean, the primary purpose of the letter was to inform them about why the current situation exists and, you know, that basically the service needs their help to try and rectify this position.
Because the service, as we know before, and you tell us in the letter, in February 2021, by the way, there are 144 children attending paediatric diabetes services in Mullingar. In February 2021, you were on the verge of having to close the service.
Yeah, Joe. So I suppose at that time, and this was primarily, obviously, unfortunately for a lot of our patients, this is the second time that they have faced uncertainty about the local service. But obviously there are new patients who wouldn't have known any of this. So it was important for them to understand that we've been in difficult situation before. I think the circumstances, the end result is obviously a lack of staff, but the circumstances this time are somewhat different to the last time.
And you say the first verge of permanent closure, being on the verge of permanent closure, came when you said, at the end of a lengthy period of time whereby I had single-handedly sustained diabetes clinics for 18 months and denied myself my basic leave entitlements while advocating for the necessary resources to keep the service open. That's pretty strong in itself. And what has happened now that we are on the verge again of a very, very difficult situation? It pertains to a nurse who we call Mary, just for the sake of the discussion here.
Perfect. Yeah, that's no problem. So, as outlined in the letter, Joe, there's 144 patients in the service, and diabetes is a condition where there are defined ratios for patients to nursing, and based on our patients in terms of the type of treatment that they're on, the current clinic workload would be equivalent to the nursing workload of 2.6 nurses.
Okay.
We have, since last September, had a temporary absence of a member of the nursing team. So we've had Mary, as we're referring to her too, has had to carry the entire nursing workload herself. Which obviously isn't a sustainable position. And again, as outlined, when she has a week off, she comes back to 2 weeks' work. And she's already doing the work of 2.6 nurses. So I suppose what needed to happen was that, you know, we needed a temporary replacement for the nurse who was absent, just to support Mary, as we're calling her. And then, you know, she'd have a much more manageable workload. And obviously, and I've outlined this in the letter as well, we're very good at recording our patient outcomes in this service in real time.
Yeah.
And we can see that since we've gone down to one nurse, that, you know, obviously patient outcomes are slipping because it is an unmanageable workload. And, you know, it is a very hard position for anyone. to be in, that they are working themselves extremely hard and everything is slipping away for the want of, you know, patient outcomes are deteriorating no matter how hard that the, you know, this particular nurse works.
And you say, although a temporary replacement for this role was advertised and interviewed, the successful candidate was not released into the role by nursing management. Did they not realise how serious the situation was?
I think events of, you know, 2021, nobody seems to have learned anything. I think very few people have an understanding about what type of condition type 1 diabetes is, how hard it is for families to do this every day. You know, the huge support that they need to ensure that their child is in the best possible health and will live, you know, as long and healthy and fruitful a life as they can possibly live. So people don't, I think there's a perception that diabetes is not a serious condition. And that's fundamentally, you know, a huge issue. And, you know, that's I suppose part of the reason why, you know, the service has been under such pressure.
You'll go into details about the different conditions and the positive outcomes on the one hand when you have resources. But then you put in this paragraph, which was the one that was highlighted to us as the most succinct and in one sense damning in your piece. Consider the following analogy. Would you like to tell us that analogy, please, Michael?
Sure, Joe. Consider the following analogy to illustrate what it is like to work as a frontline worker for the HSE. As a new employee, you're like a new car. All seems well at first, but then you're asked to carry more passengers than is safe to do so. Your engine is revved excessively and never serviced. Your tyres go bald. You ask for new tyres and are told they are unnecessary. You continue to drive as directed and you experience a blowout, followed shortly thereafter by another one. You are now driving on two wheels and raise this concern with management. You are told that others are managing perfectly well on two wheels, and at that point you come to understand that management don't recognise the difference between a car and a motorcycle. You are expected to continue driving, but eventually, and somewhat predictably, you crash. Management have no idea why the crash happened and come to the conclusion that the car must have been defective and the crash therefore unavoidable.
That is so devastating. The analogy. I don't know where you came up with the analogy. It's extraordinarily powerful and vivid. And it is as bad as that, is it, Michael?
I mean, Joe, I would think the reason I used an analogy is that somebody who doesn't work in the public service, I think, wouldn't believe some of the stuff you tell them. So I suppose that everybody knows what a car is like. Everybody knows what is required to look after a car. And, you know, so I think that just puts it in perspective.
It sure does. And then you add, we cannot assume that the outcome this time will be a positive one. And if things don't change, the service will again be facing permanent closure. So that's what's ahead, unless something happens immediately.
Yeah, Joe. And I suppose the terrible thing about all of this is that it is a very simple fix that's required. We're not looking for, you know, huge resources. We're looking for a little bit of help for one particular staff member, and for that staff member to be treated with, I think, the respect that they deserve to be treated with.
And you say, I can say again in writing, I can say hand on heart, I've never received such positive feedback about anyone I've ever worked with. She is quite simply irreplaceable. Mary, not her name, as you all know, has type 1 diabetes. This is obviously in the public domain and was diagnosed when she was a teenager. She understands the burden of managing a condition that never takes a break and never gives you one. She's extraordinarily positive and obviously like most medics, but in this case, Mary has extra life experience because of her own condition. And she also said, you say, she also had the experience of growing up in an under-resourced diabetic service and knows the impact the lack of support has both on children and their families. Now, we've had a response through to Robert Troy, the Fianna Fáil TD in the area, and the response he said he got from the management in Mullingar, and he says currently the management of Mullingar, in response to your urgent plea, as you heard articulated there from Professor Michael O'Grady, who we're talking to, National Clinical Lead for Paediatric Diabetes. The management of the Regional Hospital of Mullingar say currently the CNM11 Paediatric Diabetes is on scheduled leave. That is Mary, but as Michael pointed out, it's not like the rest of us. When people go on leave, when they come back, there's somebody has been there in the 2 or 3 weeks or whatever doing the work. But when Mary comes back, the first week she's trying to catch up on the work that hasn't been done. But anyway, she's on scheduled leave. Management know that. But due to pressures on the paediatric nursing team, it has not been possible to date to release a staff member to provide cover for this leave. The senior nurse management team are continuing to explore all options in an effort to achieve this. Are you aware that they are continuing, that they're trying to solve it, Michael?
I will acknowledge there are pressures across paediatric services from a nursing perspective in this hospital. But there has to be some acknowledgement of, one person missing out of a team of 20 nurses versus one person missing out of a team of 2 nurses.
Yes,
they're very, very different. Yeah. So absolutely that is correct. And sorry, in reference to the CNM, so that I think it's CNM2. It's supposed to be Roman numerals. Joe,
nurse
that's on leave since September. That's not Mary, as you refer to her. So that's the leave situation that has caused the deficit.
And the reason we were contacted, as you know, by parents, because you said in your letter, somewhat unbelievably, I'm writing again to ask you to use your collective voices to save your local diabetes service. And that's how the people who, parents who received this letter contacted us, and that's how we're talking to you. Now, again, this letter gets more, and I presume, and I do hope, that local newspapers publish it and national newspapers publish it in full. And Professor O'Grady, what in one sense I can hear you saying you don't want words anymore, you want action. What action do you want and when do you want it?
Well, I mean, I think, time is of the essence, as always, with diabetes. And again, we've illustrated that in figures. With how quickly things can slip away in terms of outcomes. So this needs to be sorted as soon as possible. We need additional nursing support.
Okay, Professor, I'm very conscious of your time, Michael. You've given us 20 minutes and your words are in themselves powerful, and I need not add anything to it. But hopefully the powers that be hear it. But above all, heed it. That is Professor Michael O'Grady, consultant paediatrician and paediatric endocrinologist, National Clinical Lead for Paediatric Diabetes, and he's based in the Midland Regional Hospital in Mullingar. Michael, good afternoon, and thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Thank you, thank you. Let's go to the women who contacted us about this letter, Vivian Matthews O'Neill and Janice and Reel. Vivian, good afternoon. What's your situation, Vivian?
Okay, firstly, thanks for raising this, Joe. We are so concerned as parents. I think the letter referred to 145 children. And my son is one of those children. So he's not just a number, he is a person.
Yeah.
He has just turned 8 years old. He was diagnosed with diabetes approximately 15 months ago, and it turned our world upside down. Like, ultimately, I myself am a diabetic for the last 36 years. I've lived through all of this. So I was very lucky in one sense that I caught my son before he fell into a diabetic coma. I brought him into Mullingar. I met with the nurses. I met with Professor O'Grady. And we've been in constant contact with them since to try and get his levels right. People do not understand, Joe, the importance of good control in young diabetics. I was diagnosed when I was a young child as well, very different to now. It's come on so much and so advanced now in comparison, which is amazing. But just, I cannot stress how, I know we're referring to her as Mary. Like, ultimately, she is like an absolute gift to that clinic. She is ultimately there at the end of a phone call. She's there at the end of an email. She'll always help you. She understands exactly what's going on. She understands how they feel. She understands what a low feels like. Until you have one, you don't know. She understands how you feel when you're high. She understands the difference in hormones, growth spurts, activity, parties, et cetera, et cetera. We met with Professor O'Grady yesterday because we had our son's appointment as standard. And I just couldn't get over it. The man is broken. Yeah. Like, ultimately, this is not on. I have raised this issue through our local TDs since last October. I went so far as to get my own son's name mentioned on the floor of the Dáil to try and get them some help. And nothing has been done since last October.
And so when this letter was sent out by Prof O'Grady, you weren't surprised?
I wasn't surprised, okay? So ultimately, Niamh is amazing. Mary is amazing. Okay. Like, she is ultimately fabulous. And she'd be in constant communication. Thankfully, my son got an insulin pump about a month ago. And the change to his life is already amazing. But he does need tweaks to his numbers and his ratios and his background insulin, et cetera, right? So I've been in contact with Niamh over the last couple of weeks by email saying, look, Niamh, could you have a look at this if you get a chance? I know you're extremely busy. And every time she'd come back to you within a day or two and she'd say, right, that's not working. We'd do this. We'd change that. And I had contacted Niamh just to say, thanks very much, Niamh. Appreciate it. I'll make those changes. 10 days before last Wednesday. So that was the last contact I had with her. And then last Wednesday evening at about 8:10, I got an out of the blue, out of office email to say, please note, I am now on indefinite leave. Yeah. Professor O'Grady will communicate to parents. Now, there is a Facebook group for parents of children.
And the letter that Prof O'Grady sent out is just over 1,000 words. And it is, I've been sitting on this desk for a long, long time at this stage, and I've done a lot of, through our listeners, a lot of talk about the HSE. This is the most devastating 1,000 words I've ever read about the HSE. And I go back to, I can't read out the whole letter in full. As I say, hopefully others, and we will try and publish it in full as well. But the analogy that Professor O'Grady makes, and he talks about it there, and he read it out during the programme about the car, and I'll tweet that actual paragraph because it is so devastating. Consider the following analogy. This is from the National Clinical Lead on Paediatric Diabetes in Ireland. He says, consider the following analogy to illustrate what it is like to work as a frontline worker for the HSE. As a new employee, you are like a new car. All seems well at first, but then you are asked to carry more passengers than it is safe to do so. Your engine is revved excessively and never serviced. Your tyres go bald. You ask for new tyres and you are told they are unnecessary. You continue to drive as directed and you experience a blowout, followed shortly thereafter by another blowout. You're now driving on two wheels and raise this concern with HSE management. You were told that others are managing perfectly well on two wheels And at this point, you come to understand that HSE management don't recognise the difference between a car and a motorcycle. You were expected to continue driving, but eventually, and somewhat predictably, you crash. Management have no idea why the crash happened and come to the conclusion that the car must have been defective and the crash was therefore unavoidable. Now, is that not damning?
And demanding, demanding of us.
But he's well, as Michael O'Grady said, he is prepared 100% to stand over what he's written in that letter, no matter how difficult it might be for the management and indeed politicians to read and Department of Health to read. He is prepared to stand over every single word in that letter.
And I think what's crucial there, Joe, is that ultimately, Professor O'Grady is a really is an experienced professional man. He also you cannot understand, like, he's on call. He's the paediatric lead of the unit in Mullingar also, not just the diabetic clinic.
Yeah, okay.
Like, ultimately, he is far and wide very much respected within his own field. Like, I am an adult diabetic now. I don't attend Mullingar. I attend Dublin. But he's very much respected in his field across the board by other endocrinologists in this country.
Okay.
So ultimately, for somebody to be that brave, to come out and put his own neck on the line, to call on help. And this is not help that's needed yesterday or the day before. This is help that was needed 6 months ago plus.
Yeah.
It's not fair. The other thing is as well that ultimately we don't know how many other diabetics are going to be diagnosed. Like, there's been 8 diabetics diagnosed in Mullingar since January. So if anyone attends Mullingar, the first person you meet and the comfort blanket that you get is the nurse. The nurse guides you through the training. I'm lucky, but I know about carb counting. I know about ratios. I know about how every bit of food you put in your stomach has to be weighed out and calculated if you want good control. What about the parent that has no diabetic history in their family and they're thrown into this and their child may be in what's referred to as DKA? They're put in intensive care and then they're told you have to inject your child until the child is ready to do it. It's absolutely traumatic, Joe. The nurse there is a true comfort. She guides you through the training. Mm-hmm. She gives you the comfort. She gives you her own personal contact number. Ring me anytime.
Incredible.
And
as I said earlier, Mary, as we're calling her, she herself went through this experience as a child. Okay, stay with us, Vivian, and I will talk to more people who've contacted us about this devastating situation in the Midlands, as raised by Professor Michael O'Grady through the parents, and it was the parents who contacted us. 0818 715 815, joe at rt.ie, 51551 is the text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We're talking about a letter that was sent out, and there's no need for April Fool's gags at this stage, but parents got it on April the 2nd, and it's a 1,000-word letter, just slightly over, written by Professor Michael O'Grady, consultant paediatrician, paediatric endocrinologist and national clinical lead for paediatric diabetes based in Mullingar. And he's basically saying that once again, we face imminent closure. This really important service. He said, we cannot assume that the outcome this time will be a positive one. And if things don't change, the service will again be facing permanent closure. And I said, it is a devastating letter, and you heard Professor O'Grady read out sections of it earlier in the programme, and you will realise in itself how devastating it is, but no more devastating than to the parents who got it. Janice Reel. Janice, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good, good, thanks. How are you, more importantly? You, I presume, as with Vivian, you're aware how things were getting much worse, but you got this letter. What was your reaction?
My first reaction, Joe, was I didn't know whether to laugh, cry, sit down, faint. I didn't know what it means for my own son, because unlike Vivian, when my son got his diagnosis, it was like somebody literally kicked me in the stomach. Yeah. I knew nothing about diabetes. It's not in the immediate family.
Yeah.
He went in with a head injury from a football match and came out as a diabetic.
Okay.
Literally, carb counting was a minefield. Injections were a minefield. Ketones, blood glucose, all of that was completely... It was like a foreign language to me and my husband and my other children. So as Vivian has said, Mary, the nurse, was...
just like an angel. She came in, she showed my son Rean her own pump. She told him that she was a diabetic.
Yeah.
At one stage, while he was in hospital, he ended up picking up a gastro bug. And in the middle of the gastro bug, he was in what they call a hypo. So his sugars had dropped low. We were trying to treat him. Every time we treat him, he was vomiting. And Mary herself at the time went into the same hypo. So we had two diabetics in hypos at the same time. She left the room. She didn't panic us. She didn't let us know until afterwards. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is just amazing. And to take her out of the service is just, it's beyond words, Joe, to be honest with you. You could not cope without herself, Michael, and all of the multidisciplinary team that they have. It is a vital service to the diabetics of the Midlands.
But how has it got to this, where this consultant has to write such a brutally honest letter, which read in a different context might actually damage him in terms of, but obviously yep. he's beyond, and his medical credentials are above reproach, but might damage him in terms of promotion or whatever, but he's not in administration, so it doesn't arise. But it is a pretty devastating letter. Insofar as you know, Janice, I hope the parents have managed. I know it's difficult to contact each other. I know you've contacted us. But is there any way the parents can bring even more political pressure onto the Department of Health, onto the Minister for Health, onto the incoming Taoiseach, who was Minister for Health? And as we discovered a few weeks ago when he was Minister for Health, and that issue arose, which arose again a few weeks ago, but was dealt with differently. That issue arose under his watch, where the Department of Health removed, without telling him, aids to women who had breast cancer. He immediately and defiantly, in a tweet, told the Department of Health, his department, to get lost, basically, and rescind the decision, which they did immediately. And that's when he was a Minister for Health, and he was known for his decisiveness. So maybe he will hear this and do something. Because as Professor O'Grady said, Janice, the solution is relatively straightforward. It's not beyond an organisation and a department of government and a section of our state that has a budget of nearly 20 billion.
Yeah, and Joe, as he said to me yesterday, this time around, I wasn't in the service the first time around when it closed, lucky enough, but now I'm unfortunately in it. He said this time around, it's not a budgeting issue. The staff member has been trained up, was due to join the service, and then wasn't allowed to leave the ward that she was on. So it's bad management. It is literally on the management of Mullingar Hospital that are stopping our children getting the life-saving treatment, services, backup support that they need to keep them safe and healthy.
And I'm sure management would say there is an embargo. We didn't decide on the embargo. We've got pressures yep. above us and beside us and beyond us. But anyway, Professor O'Grady has definitely put the pressure back on them.
Oh, 100%, and he has the backing of all the parents. We, Joe, as a group, there is a Facebook group, a support group for type 1 parents of children and teens. We've gotten together between the whole of Ireland. We have then also set up with the Mullingar parents. There's mm-hmm. a WhatsApp group. There's a Facebook group. We are in constant contact. As you can imagine, from the time we got the email yesterday, nothing has been done bar diabetes. We have contacted Robert Troy, Peter Burke, Sorka Clark, ministers all across the region, local councillors, mm. TDs, yourself. We've been on local radio. I actually spoke myself this morning on Midlands 103. I spoke to RTE this morning. It's gone. Anyone that we can get this story out to, we are, willing to do anything, no matter what it is, protests, anything. The parents of the Mullingar children will do what it takes.
And it's obvious that Professor Michael O'Grady, who you heard here, will do what it takes. Maria Bourke, Maria, yes. You're listening. Go ahead, Maria.
I am, Joe. I just caught the tail end of that wonderful speaker and the letter he sent in. And wow, did he really hit the nail on the head. We're dealing with people's lives mm-hmm. and you're dealing with a service. Now, I work as a public health nurse and we provide an excellent service.
I know.
But are hugely, hugely struggling on the front line. And our populations are growing, but yet we're getting no extra staff to assist us. And when I hear, about managers, I mean, the HSE is top heavy with managers. Managers managing managers, and I do feel they're a little bit out of touch of the reality of what's happening on the front line. We're privileged to be going into people and providing support mm-hmm. and listening to those parents Like, you'll do anything, absolutely anything, for your children.
And as you say, and you use the exact phrase that Prof O'Grady used, the situation as a frontline worker in the HSE. This is what Professor O'Grady told us, an extract from what he told us about 20 minutes ago.
Consider the following analogy to illustrate what it is like to work as a frontline worker for the HSE. As a new employee, you're like a new car. All seems well at first, but then you're asked to carry more passengers than is safe to do so. Your engine is revved excessively and never serviced. Your tyres go bald. You ask for new tyres and are told they are unnecessary. You continue to drive as directed and you experience a blowout, followed shortly thereafter by another one. You are now driving on two wheels and raise this concern with management. You are told that others are managing perfectly well on two wheels, and at that point you come to understand that management don't recognise the difference between a car and a motorcycle. You are expected to continue driving, but eventually, and somewhat predictably, you crash. Management have no idea why the crash happened and come to the conclusion that the car must have been defective and the crash, therefore, unavoidable.
And Maria, does that resonate with you?
Oh, my God. Is he writing my story, Joe? And, you know, I'm really passionate about what I do. I love my job. I think we're really well trained here in Ireland and we provide an excellent service, but we are struggling. We're putting on plasters. And I've been saying it for a number of years. And unfortunately, there's an element of fear out there. People are afraid to speak their truth. They're afraid to say it how it is. But this is how it is. And listen to us. Listen to us. And I really hope Bernard Gloucester is listening to this. And I have written to Bernard in the past. I've written to the Ministers for Health. I mean, we are just sinking at the seams. I'm 60 and there's very few of my age group left because there's... We're swamped with paperwork, with emails, with work on the computer and taking us away from the real frontline work. What we do, what we loved, what we're trained for.
Paul Gillespie is on the line. Paul, good afternoon. Donegal, go ahead, Paul. You're chairman of the Donegal branch of Diabetes Ireland. Did what Professor O'Grady tell us, and indeed we extracted most of the letter there, Did what he said resonate with you in Donegal?
Oh, it has been, yeah. And they mentioned there that, you know, that writing to the ministers, we have actually been meeting the consecutive ministers for health over the last 10 years to try and get proper care into Letterkenny Hospital and going nowhere. We're banging our head against a brick wall. We're part of the Silcha group. I'm not sure if actually Mullingar may be part of Silcha group as well. But Silcha are refusing to implement the Centre of Excellence. Whenever Leo Varadkar was actually Minister for Health, he signed into law the guideline from the HSE and the Department of Health is that there should be a Centre of Excellence for children with type 1 diabetes and that, you know, a paediatric endocrinologist is vital for the proper care of all children. And so with the numbers across Donegal, we have actually, I think it's close now to 160 children with type 1 diabetes, and there's no pediatric endocrinologist in Letterkenny. They rely now, thankfully, we, like the previous ladies' parents that were on there, we have brilliant nurses, and they are really carrying the can. And if it wasn't for them, I'm not sure what would happen across Donegal. But the question has to be asked, why for the last 10 years... is each consecutive Minister for Health, and we've met them all. We met the most recent one, Stephen Donnelly, last year, highlighted the problems there. And every time we meet a Minister for Health and they says, oh, this is terrible, this has to be rectified. But they do nothing, or else it's either the HSE don't implement it, or my main concern is that Silcha do not take it seriously. That diabetes, type 1 diabetes, is a life-threatening condition. Yeah. Like there's absolutely there's no psychology support for children and families trying to cope with a life-threatening condition across the Silcha area, and Letterkenny, we're getting great support at the minute, and our TDs are really pushing to try and get answers. Why is Donegal, why is Letterkenny being neglected so badly? And they send in the questions, and I actually sent in letters directly to Tony Gannavan, and I got a reply from the chief officer, Anne Cosgrave, and they don't answer the question. My question was, why is there no centre of excellence? And they come back with all these aspirational answers of, this is what we are applying for, but there's nothing in place. And this has gone on now for years. At the minute now, thankfully, due to the nurses and the paediatrics in Letterkenny, the children and new families that have been diagnosed, they are getting lovely care. I'm actually managing to see them every 3 months. But once they transition into adult services in Donegal, they fall off a cliff. There is no adult services. It's all vacant posts now at the minute in Letterkenny Hospital.
Okay.
There's no adult endocrinologists. There's no ANPs. There's no podiatrists. Letterkenny and Donegal has been totally neglected by this government and by Saoilte.
Okay, even though I'm sure they would argue the opposite. It's the Saoilte Hospital Group, and their motto is excellence and care. But anyway, thanks, Neil Paul. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We were contacted by a number of parents this morning about a letter they received yesterday, and indeed this morning, in some cases, from Professor Michael O'Grady, who's National Clinical Lead for Paediatric Diabetes, and the situation he paints for services for children with diabetes, which he is in charge of and has been holding together for a number of years, is critical, to say the least. And he asked parents to try and help and reach out and try and get support. Now, Adele, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe, how are you?
Good, thanks. It's your 8-year-old child.
Yeah, so we're just under a year in with our just gone 8-year-old child, and I missed the start of the show, but really just to echo the points that the last man made, because we've got a great group, well, smaller group than we started with, of nurses in Kilkenny, which they're brilliant. I can't speak highly enough of them, that cover Kilkenny and Carlow. But and we're currently like giving our child 5 injections a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of understand that after about a year, the next logical step is that you might start from a pump. But unfortunately, Kilkenny have had to stop the rollout of pumps. So we're just kind of worried about the future of the clinics there. We're worried about the staff that are left there getting extremely burnt out, because they're really, really working hard, like similar to what the last guy was saying about Donegal. And I just think that not enough attention is being put on this and making sure that there are services there for these little tiny kids, that like it has such an impact on them and the whole family, and the injections. It's such a big deal, and you know, you don't really realise it till it happens to you.
And Professor, and it's a very, very difficult situation, I know, and very, very worrisome. And I think people are inclined to think that diabetes type 2 is primarily for adults, and they their partners know how to test the insulin, they know how to measure, finger prick, they know how to inject.
Yeah.
But for children, because it's type 1 diabetes, for some reason, some people think it's much less serious, but it's not. Because as Vivian pointed out, and Vivian, I know you alluded to it, but you on the one hand, you were, because you're a diabetic yourself, you knew what to look out for, even though you did not know it was coming. But go back to that point you said, where when you discovered that your son, Oliver, you tell us, your son Oliver was in trouble, and you recognised immediately what it was. And if you hadn't...
Yeah, Joe, like, I swear to God, I can't stress this enough. Like, it was the day of the toy show, November 25th of November 2022. And I've been working quite excessively up to that point. I was working on something quite serious for my own job, and I was working quite late, and that Thursday evening, and I said, right, I'm shutting down the laptop at 6 o'clock, guys. We're going to get the Christmas tree up. We're going to get ready for the toy show. It's the start of Christmas in our house. Always has been. We put up the toy, you know, we pull down the tree, get the decorations, everything. And if anyone who knows Oliver knows he is the most bubbly, he's the most charismatic little fella. You know, way beyond his years. Like, I cannot stress enough how funny he is, and just how kind of easygoing and nosy and all the rest of it. And he was helping Mom put up the Christmas tree, and he got all the decorations, and he was all good. And the next day was the toy show, so they were getting ready for school, and they went down, and my two little lads went down and picked out their jumpers that they were going to wear, and they picked out a Santa hat. And then Oliver got very upset and he wanted a bell. He wanted a jingle bell on it. So I got the needle and thread out and I sewed the jingle bell onto the hat. And oh, sure, it all erupted again and he was roaring, crying, and said he didn't want a jingle bell. So I said, grand, no bother. There's the scissors. Cut it off. Off to bed, good luck. I thought that because it was the time around the football as well, the football was on and they were watching the football. My guys are mad about anything to do with the ball.
Okay.
And I thought he was tired. So off he went to bed. That was fine. And he went to bed. That was fine. He had an accident that night, something he hasn't done since he was since he was potty trained. And he came in to us and he had got his jammies changed and like way beyond his years, got his jammies changed, climbed in between the two of us. And that was grand. Okay. And I had an accident, mommy. I was like, okay, come on. I'll clean up the bed. Let's go.
Okay.
I got up the following morning about 20 past six, had my shower. Oliver got up, had his shower. And then he came up to the kitchen and I was like, what do we get for breakfast? And he started crying again, Joe.
Okay.
Totally out of character. Just totally out of character. And I was like, what's wrong? And he was like, oh, I just want a bell. I was like, oh, good Jesus, this bell again. I said, grand, I'll put the bell on. It'll be fine. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to check your sugars. Now, I have often checked my boy's sugars over the years.
Okay.
If they're just crying for no reason. Because my own mom said to me when I was about, when I was diagnosed when I was five, and my sister was only 2 weeks old. She was there and she said, you sat in the middle of the floor and you cried. You cried, you cried, you cried. And
okay.
I said, what on God's green earth? And she knew immediately. So that was grand. And I was rocked off anyway. But I checked his sugar and they were 22, Joe. Now, a normal sugar for anyone who doesn't have diabetes should be between 4 and maybe 6 or 7, fasting sugar.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, good Jesus. So I let a roar at my husband and I said, oh, my God, what is going on? And he said, look, calm down, wash the hands. I said, okay, yeah, could have been a candy cane. You know, I knew, but I was just trying to convince myself it wasn't. That was fine. Washed his hands, scrubbed his hands, checked the sugar again, 25. So I went into my office, I had a good cry for myself, and I rang the MyDoc. And I told the MyDoc, and she was amazing. And she said, right, is he having heart palpitations? Is he unconscious? Is he breathing? Has he swallowed his tongue? These are the normal things that happen when a child goes into a diabetic coma.
Okay.
And this is normally how children are diagnosed. And I said, no, none of that. She said, you need to get him into A&E immediately. He needs help. And I said, yeah, okay, grand. Okay, so we got him packed up. We got our young fella off to our childminder. She's amazing. We got our eldest lad who's in secondary school off on the bus to school. God love him because I was totally traumatised. And we went straight into Mullingar and we then went in. I had said to them, look, with the history that's in our family, I think it's diabetes.
Yeah, yeah.
They did a check. They did a ketone check. And the ketones are when your body can't break down insulin. Your body doesn't have insulin. Okay, so your pancreas shuts down. It shuts down slowly, Joe. It's not something that happens overnight. But sometimes it might give a little burst of insulin and it might decide, I'm going to work well today. And that's why you don't catch it. You know, it's not suddenly, oh, there you go. Good luck. And that was the start of our journey. Just totally traumatic.
And you can imagine how people like Edel, who pointed out that she had, like most of us, as you know, Edel, had no experience of what was happening and what to look out for. I want to bring in Professor Matthew Harmy, a retired professor of molecular biology at UCD. Matt, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The reason that I ring you, really, is the diabetic nurse is a gem.
Yeah.
And actually, when you work out that if you have to bring a child who's had a diabetic coma to A&E and, you know, be flushed out and looked after, you're talking about 10 grand.
Wow.
So if you had 10 of those avoided, that's 100,000.
Incredible.
Well enough to pay a good diabetic nurse. And I've been a diabetic, I mean, I got an infection when I was doing my PhD.
Okay.
And I've been a diabetic now for over 60 years. And I've been with, you know, diabetic nurses. And I know, you know, what they do. And nowadays, the advances are such that I have a little patch on me. And that patch talks to my mobile phone.
Yes, yes.
It'll talk to another person if I put them on sharing it. And this makes it so easy, you know, for them to manage. But they need, you know, a well-trained diabetic nurse to keep them, you know, in order with that. And it's funny that this happens years ago. I spoke to the health officer down in Wicklow when I lived in Wicklow and said, you know, why don't we have a diabetic nurse here? Because you're sending people up by taxi to James's or Vincent's to get blood tests done. I said, you know, a diabetic nurse is really an absolute marvel in you know, in treating diabetes. But it's an old score with them. I had a very good consultant, and he told me one day, he said, I can get money to beat the band if I want to clone this or clone that or do, you know, the fancy things in molecular biology. He said, but they won't pay a diabetic nurse for me.
Yeah.
So he said, hump them, and he went off to Norway and ran a big clinic there.
And as you say, Matt, a diabetic nurse, he or she, are worth their weight in gold. But we're also discovering that the diabetic nurse in Mullingar, her prof was on, and he's the lead in the unit. He said she was doing the work of close on three nurses. And it also meant that when she, which she's entitled to, take her legitimate breaks, she would come back, not to any of the work, to a backlog of a mountain. And she's already doing the work of close on three people. So
it's really short-sighted, unbelievably short-sighted, and financially a disaster.
Yeah, I don't know whether, did you hear Professor?
Did
you hear his point about the car?
The car
on two wheels.
The bangles.
Devastating.
No, I don't know if that goes, I mean, there's such a huge number of diabetics now. Yeah. I mean, they're increasing, probably, because of dietary habits or what have you. But at the same time, they're not all due to that. I got diabetes because I got meningitis.
And as you say, on the one hand, we live in a world where technology, especially through the patches through your mobile phone, is very good at alerting you about your insulin levels. And that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, the human element is being, as Professor O'Grady said, being neglected. And you can only go on so long when you're doing the work of three people non-stop.
You do. It'll mean more people be ending up in A&E.
Okay.
And that costs more than her salary.
Yeah, here. Okay, Professor Matt Harmy, retired molecular biologist in UCD. Go to Mila Mahaga, Joe at rt.ie, 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Spruce up your home this Easter with our exciting sale on curtains and bedding. Pop in store today.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Damien Flynn, you're listening to Professor O'Grady. You have a seven-year-old daughter.
So we're relatively new to the service. We weren't around in 2021 when...
Okay.
The service nearly closed permanently. So, so we've been diagnosed on 15th of December 23, and we received excellent care and education from the endocrinologist team from Prof. O'Grady and Niamh. Such great care that my daughter's HbA1c has come down from 85 at diagnosis to 52 on our recent appointment last week. And that's Joe, that's not by chance. That's true.
Yeah, so, of course.
Working between the excellent team and ourselves. We weren't surprised to get the letter. We were expecting it. We met with Prof. O'Grady last week, and we knew things weren't good. I suppose kind of the communication. Mm-hmm. Niamh was covering one nurse for 145. It's a skeleton service. She was doing her best, but she couldn't get back to, you know, parents. Obviously, parents are just worried about their own child. They kind of look for answers there and then, but you can't get around them all. So she did her best and, you know, helped us out greatly. You know, we were suffering with, like prolonged kind of highs, and she made adjustments to insulin and ratios. She was doing the job of the dietitian as well.
And I'll remind you mentioned, Damon, sorry for cutting across, but I just want to go back to, you mentioned February 2021 when you first came in. This is what Professor O'Grady wrote yesterday about February 2021. In February 2021, I wrote to all parents of children attending the paediatric diabetes service, informing them that clinics were cancelled with immediate effect and that unless appropriate multidisciplinary team resources were put in place within a matter of months, that the closure of the service would be permanent. This is 2021. This came at the end of a lengthy period of time whereby I had single-handedly sustained diabetes clinics for 18 months and denied myself my basic leave entitlements while advocating for the necessary resources to keep the service open. And then he's now prompted I know parents were aware of it, but the letter only went out in the last 48 hours. And he's now prompted again to say the service is in danger of closing again because of what's happening. So it's I'll stay with us, Damien, and I'll go to Grainne Cleary. Grainne, please, you have a 10-year-old child.
I do. He was diagnosed there last August, and it was the first time really I kind of ever got to really know anything much about type 1 diabetes. Like, it was fairly new to me. I didn't even know, like, there was a lot of people in my family, like distant relatives, that had it as well. So, you know, it was like a real hard hit in the head. We caught it early enough. Like, we were lucky. Like, he was having accidents. I never even thought that would be anything. I thought it was maybe hormones or something, because of his age. But when we brought him into the doctors and found his levels were like so high that he was just on the verge of going into a diabetic coma. So he was just lucky enough we caught him. We were sent straight over, and at that point then they started the process of, you know, checking him in and everything and all that, and we were pretty much told there and then that he had type 1 diabetes. So it was a big life change. And the whole team, like, over there, they know, I mean, have been a godsend. Like, they've helped so much, especially with the fact as well, like, he was diagnosed then in October with autism. So that kind of answered a lot of questions there as well, because he has an awful ferocious kind of diet, you know, and kids that have autism sometimes don't have the filter on when to stop. So with type 1 diabetes and his fairly large appetite, it's kind of was harder for us to manage because of that. Like, you know what I mean? Because it's hard to tell him when to stop. So, because the more carbs he gets into his system, you know what I mean, the higher his blood sugar, like, his level can go.
And it has to be monitored almost scientifically,
Like, you know what I mean? There's many nights now, like, you know what I mean? Like, at the start, trying to kind of, you know what I mean, get everything stable. Like, many nights you'd be up nearly all night, like, you know what I mean? Just with worry and trying to kind of get his blood sugar levels down to a safe area, like, you know what I mean, making sure he doesn't go into, like, you know, a diabetic coma. And, like, he can go into one on either side of it, you know what I mean, if the blood sugar levels go too high or too low.
It's so, like, worrying. If it happens, so worrying.
You know, so, like, they are definitely, they're needed, like, you know what I mean?
And if the unit, if the unit in Mullingar, God forbid, was to close, you'd have to rush to Dublin.
Yeah, exactly. And I have another child as well, like, who's just turned a teenager last year, and she's on the spectrum as well at the moment, being assessed for ASD as well. So, and, you know, for her, there's a lot of things that we kind of struggle with, like, you know what I mean, like, even getting her outside the door to do stuff, like, so even her going up to Dublin, because, like, we wouldn't have anyone to take care of him, so we'd have to bring her along, and that's a very busy area. I mean, she'd be going into social anxiety panic attacks. So it'd be like, you know what I mean, it's not just, you know what I mean, when you're dealing with this, like, you have to look at all the variables, like, you know what I mean, because every family has different things that they're dealing with. So it's a lot to take on, and it's a lot to kind of process. It can be quite hard, like, you know what I mean, when you're quite new to all and you have other issues in the family already.
And it's as Vivian pointed out earlier, she was lucky in the sense that she had been through this. But I was reading earlier on the HSE booklet on dealing with children who have diabetes. It's nearly a course you have to take in terms of what to do and when to inject, how to measure, how to do the finger prick, how to measure the finger. It's an incredible, incredible.
Yeah, you're brought in for training and everything. And when you're first in the hospital, you can't actually leave until the nurses are actually happy enough that you know what you're going to be doing, because it's such a serious life-threatening disease that you have to be able to do exactly everything properly, or it could cause more damage.
You can imagine the stress you're under and the pressure. Stay there, Grania. Amy Flynn. Amy, Professor O'Grady, who you heard, as I say, at the start of the programme, and the paragraphs I read out talking about him and the sacrifices he made, he didn't ask me to read them. Yeah. I read them out because he's a very modest man. But tell us your experience, please, Amy.
He's just absolutely amazing, Joe. Thank you for everything, for covering this today.
Well, it was the calls from the parents, yourself.
Yeah, tell us. We have a ball group together. There's a good group of us here.
Great.
Well, there's no diabetes in my family, so it was all very brand new to me. And the first weekend that we were in hospital, Professor O'Grady was going away. And he just said to me, I'll be in charge of your child. I will look after her. I will, work out the insulin levels and everything for her. And I will be in touch with you before I get on the plane. I'll get in touch again when I'm off the plane, and I will be contactable the whole time I'm away. And I kind of looked at him and went, just that's not sustainable. It's your weekend off. Yeah. And he just looked at me and said, no. And he smiled and said, this is how we do things. And he just put my mind and my heart at ease. And I just knew, this is great. She's not going between doctors, different people doing different things. And then another example done of Mary is when...
The nurse,
my daughter started on the pump. She... when she started on the pump, she started on a Thursday. And on Saturday morning, I got a phone call from Niamh's personal phone. She was out and about downtown, but was still monitoring my daughter's sugars through an app. And she said, Amy, those sugars are rising. This is what we'll do. And there's no extrinsic reward here. This is just, they put in all this extra time and extra effort. They're always at the end of the phone. They go above and beyond, and they're just so understanding and so supportive of parents as well as kids. Like, my daughter's only two, and it was a huge shock, but my daughter, so she looks forward to going in to see Professor Grady and to see Mary and the rest of the team, because they're just so amazing.
And they're so amazing. And Amy, what I want, and I hope, how is your daughter doing?
She's doing well.
She has to be monitored
as much as possible.
Yeah,
and like that, we're trying to figure stuff out, because we know that they are under so much pressure over there that we're trying to figure things out and not to be ringing every time we kind of meet a problem. Whereas usually you could ring and get solved within like half an hour. But I'm very aware that they are under so much pressure that I feel a lot of guilt.
But he shouldn't.
Any phone calls.
And you know,
and
who
I shouldn't. And I know they wouldn't have me feel that way.
Exactly. It'll be.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, they would not have me feel this way.
These are
the
thank Amy. Right. Amy, I'm glad that the story was told too. That your story is told. A story was told about Prof O'Grady and Mary, as we're calling her, this incredible nurse who's doing the work of three. Medics, and it's come to a head, and that's why Dr. O'Grady spoke on this programme. This is the most devastating paragraph before the break that he wrote today.
Consider the following analogy to illustrate what it is like to work as a frontline worker for the HSE. As a new employee, you're like a new car. All seems well at first, but then you're asked to carry more passengers than is safe to do so. Your engine is revved excessively and never serviced. Your tyres go bald. You ask for new tyres and are told they are unnecessary. You continue to drive as directed and you experience a blowout, followed shortly thereafter by another one. You are now driving on two wheels and raise this concern with management. You are told that others are managing perfectly well on two wheels, and at that point you come to understand that management don't recognise the difference between a car and a motorcycle. You were expected to continue driving, but eventually, somewhat predictably, you crash. Management have no idea why the crash happened and come to the conclusion that the car must have been defective. and the crash therefore unavoidable.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Contacted by Peter Abbott and his daughter, indeed, Linda. Peter Abbott, Peter, good afternoon. It wasn't, unfortunately, it wasn't a good Friday for you last week. It was a bad, bad Friday. What happened, Peter?
No, Joe, it wasn't. Well, I was doing some work on the roof, and I was inside, and a few animals inside, and I made the stove, you know, to keep the things warm.
Yes.
And I changed from coal to timber.
Okay.
And I think the timber might have sparked something in the chimney,
right.
And that must have got out of the chimney, a small chimney, and... But I did not know that it happened, so I just went for a cup of tea by a neighbor, just only 50 yards.
Yeah.
And then there was a young lad from 3 years of age, and he called us, and he said he could see smoke coming from my place.
Oh, my God.
And that was it, really. Yeah, it went so quick, you know, it went terrible quick. And then a rust over, and I had a few animals inside, I had my cows inside. And so I had to take everything out. And anyway, they survived. So my dog and a few cats. Because, you know, they break your heart too, you know, those animals. And I had to move out the cows. They were in the back. So, and then within half an hour, maybe, it was all kind of, you know, gone, you know. And still, there were plenty of fire brigades and things like that, but they couldn't. The wind was there. There was no rain. We haven't rained for the last 6 months. And, it was terrible. And when you want rain, there wasn't rain. So, it went so quick. Everything is gone. I just only have my clothes on, and that was all what was left.
Oh, for God's sake. And you're standing there. You're in Castle Cove, which is near Cahir Daniel in Kerry.
Between Waterfield.
You're standing there, and you're watching your home, which you built.
Well, we came in the early 80s here, over, and... bit by bit, it was first in a workshop, but we said, look, we can live here in the workshop as well, and slowly you move out, you know, you build another bit and a small bit, and then you continue to work around in the neighborhood because it is a great community here, you know, they always give you work and things like that. That's
and
over 40 years.
And Peter, did you realize very quickly that you were not going to be able to save the house? Was the fire devastating from the beginning?
Yeah, it was very fast. You know, all the timber was dry, of course.
Yeah,
the wind. And there was felt between it. And then the wind, you know, the wind really took it off. And it went so quick, I tried to do something myself. But, you know, when I was inside to rescue my animals, it was already terrible. And I just barely made it outside myself.
Oh,
so,
and what are you now looking at on the site of your home, Peter?
Well, there's nothing anymore. There's nothing. There's nothing. Everything is flattened, and that was terrible. And I made great progress. You know, I was out of action there last year. I slipped it off my own roof, and I was knocked down for a few months.
Yeah.
So slowly I came back again and started working in my old place again. And
where are you from? Where are you from originally, Peter?
I'm original from Amsterdam, Joe.
And when did you come to Ireland?
Well, my first visit was in 71.
Okay.
That was a long time.
Yes.
When I was young. Oh my God!
Nearly
nearly
55 years ago.
I was young at the time.
Yeah, well, you still are. But you still are now, Peter. If you're up on the roof and you're doing your own building, but anyway, maybe you shouldn't be. But Peter, you came to Ireland in 1971. You're from Amsterdam originally. What made you? What made you stay and build your own home?
Well, you know, I always loved that outdoor life and.
Okay.
I was never at home in the weekend working in Amsterdam, and then in the weekends I was sailing or fishing or whatever. I love nature, of course. And yeah, and when you come to Ireland, that's a different place. You know, can we call it heaven or something? But that's what it is, you know, when you look around here. And then with this accident now here, that incident, all the help you get from all those people around you, you know, people who you don't even know, and they help. And, you know, it's amazing. It gives a great feeling that I'm not on my own, you know what
okay,
I mean?
But you're 74 years of age. When did you fall off the roof?
That was in June last year, yeah.
When you were 73?
Yeah.
And what were you doing up on the roof at 73?
Well, I was slating, and I'm very confident with that. But it was the rain. It was the rain who I slipped. Okay. And
do you remember?
You know, sometimes you do things and you shouldn't be doing.
I know.
But you know.
But do you remember hitting the ground, Peter?
No, I was laying there for a while, and then
I
got up, and then I went inside, but of course I was very sore. And then
is your house insured?
No, I wasn't, Joe. It was not such a money thing, but I thought I finished the roof and I got somebody out to put a quote on it for the insurance. So because it is not a hell of a lot of money these days. It was not about being mean or something. It was just I said, look, I want to have it right.
Yeah, well done.
Get somebody out. And that's the way it happened. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
you have a family here. Linda Bott Hamilton is your daughter, your second youngest of five girls. Yeah. Linda, good afternoon. What are we going? What are we going to do for your dad? For first of all, Pieter, it's an awful situation to be in. His life's work.
It is. It's very devastating for dad. You know, we're gutted. You know, it's our family home. It's where we all grew up. Lots of memories, you know. It's a household full of photo albums. And
oh, God. And when did you hear about the fire on Good Friday?
On Good Friday, yeah. My sister rang me, and I was up in Cork at the time, and she told me. I thought she was playing a prank on me, of course, you know. Yeah. Not something you think that would happen to your own home, you know. But yeah, obviously we all rushed down then for dad and stuff like that. But, you know, there was no saving anything, you know. It was just, it's all gone.
Yeah.
There's nothing left, you know. It's just, it's devastating, you know, all his hard work, everything he's put into it, you know. So.
And he said himself, now, he ran in and out a few times, and maybe the final time he shouldn't have, but thankfully he got out. Was there anything retrieved from the house? The animals,
no.
Obviously.
Yeah, nothing could be, like, it was just, the fire, it spread so quickly, and it was too dangerous to get anything. Even all his workshop and his tools, you know, everything's gone. It's just, there's no words really for it. It's just, it's devastating, you know. His home is gone, his whole life's work is gone.
Yeah.
His livelihood is gone, you know,
Yeah.
Oh, and Peter, what is your livelihood? Are you still building?
I was still working a bit, but I'm semi-retired, of course.
Yeah.
But
thank God.
You know, when you do things for yourself, that costs money too. So here and there, I was doing a job, and the money I made, and I spent it in my own home. But you know, I just had bought things like Velux windows and things like that. New timber, it's all gone, of course. Yeah, yeah. Look, it is so funny. You think it never happens to you, huh?
Yeah.
But then,
Okay, and I'm told when you came to Ireland originally, this is a reminder of how long ago it was, Pieter. You came in the year, I think it was the year that Sean O'Rida, the genius of Sean O'Rida, passed away, and that was part of your love of the place. Yeah.
Yeah, I was in Coolay. And he was a great composer,
of course.
make lovely music and okay. tunes, and also for the area, he was good down there.
Yeah, a great craftsman, just like yourself, Pieter, yeah, in that sense. Linda, you're trying to organise, and I know already locals, including some Ukrainians who are living down there, have been helping Pieter to clear the site.
Yeah.
But we need more, Linda, don't we? Tell us what you need and how people can help.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. So myself and my sisters just set up the GoFundMe page over the weekend, and I'm so shocked and overwhelmed with the amount of support we've gotten on it so far. In just a couple of days, there's over 55,000 on it.
Wow.
It's a testament really to the community down here and the wider community, you know, the support. You know, Dad knows a lot of people, and they're so good down here.
Well, a testament to your dad and your mom and the family that have been there for well over 50 years. So the name of the GoFundMe page is?
It's Help Pieter Bott Rebuild His House and His Life.
Okay, and Pieter spelled P-I-E-T-E-R. That will get you straight into it. Okay, Pieter, I'm so sorry this has happened to you. I hope you can get back on your feet. It sounds like you already have. If you got back on your feet, Pieter, after falling off the roof at 73 years of age, you'll get back on your feet. Though it's a devastating blow, and I know people in Castle Cove and Cahir Daniel and beyond will come together.
Yeah, they're good people down here, and I want to thank them as well.
Yeah, you're a good person, and many more years of good health to you, Pieter, and your family. On sound, good to meet you, Morgan. On sound, Liam Mullen, research John Riley, producer Nadine Maloney, Catherine Thomas is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.